with what we've come across today. 11 objects in total is what we've come across. A varying range of shapes, sizes, objects that were sitting on the surface of the ocean, some just below.
An investigation's underway into the deaths of 11 people in hospital in Northern Ireland, five of them babies. The male nurse has been rearrested in connection with a number of deaths at Stepping Hill Hospital in Stockport in 2011. Victorina Chua was detained last year on suspicion of tampering with medical records at the hospital. The sale of 30 million insurance policies in the UK over three decades from the 1970s is to be reviewed. The city regulator will look at concerns that customers were charged fees that were too high. And some people who bought Kate Bush tickets earlier today are now trying to sell them on for £1,500. All of the singer's 22 comeback dates in London were sold out in just 15 minutes this morning. The gigs at the Hammersmith Apollo are her first in 35 years. That's the latest. I'm Tom Harrigan.
Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Conservative councillor for Horfield, Claire Hiscott. She's stuck in the traffic at Eastern Way, but she'll be here very soon. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, are you fed up with seeing satellite pictures of wreckage that isn't there somewhere in the Indian Ocean? All those wasted air miles of searches that then find nothing? Well, so are the families of the 239 passengers and crew on Malaysian MH370. We explore the cyber hijack theories and, more importantly, motives for an attack on Malaysia or China. Back to the bad old days of US-sponsored military rule in Egypt this week as well, with the 250 or so death sentences handed out, as well as in Turkey shooting down a Syrian jet and a leaked phone call from Prime Minister Erdogan that he wants to attack his own country to get a war started with Syria. Well, no wonder he wants to ban Twitter and YouTube, because everybody in Turkey is talking about their crooked warmongering leader. Plus, a look at the Israel lobby and their so-called Christian supporters. What are they saying to win hearts and minds for the Tel Aviv cause? And we're joined by a former journalist from Palestine, Iqbal Tamimi. And we round off last week's interviews with what the BBC aren't reporting, that is Occupy London and their think tanks is still going strong. This week's some solutions, just so Osborne and the Treasury can't say nobody told them. To Britain's banker-induced economic nightmare, that is Occupy London's Clive Menzies. Part three, this week, we hope, at last, of a series that Paul Mason thinks could not be made in Britain today. It's called The People's First World War, Part Three, The Revolutions. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. It's tonight lows of 5 degrees Celsius and showers, some heavy. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, hazy sunshine and sunny spells. Next week, highs of 16, sunny spells and light showers. At least they're not heavy ones. Next weekend, 5th and 6th of April, highs of 11 Celsius, sunshine and a few more showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And you can tell April's here, can't you? So helping us review this week's news will be, in a minute, Conservative councillor for Horfield, Claire Hiscott. But before she arrives, stuck in traffic, Martin, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We've had some amazing announcements this week. This is on the economics front of fines. In the United States, massive fines. Here, not so much. Santander and Lloyds in this country are being criticised, but over in the US, much, much bigger fines. So can you just give us your thoughts on it's $100 billion the US government has been fining their banks. Over here, Santander has been fined $12.4 million.
Well, finding institutions doesn't actually do much good. It's as if...
Does it do any good?
I would say probably none at all. Because if you know that the institution you work for is going to pick up any fine for any misdemeanour that you may have carried out, then you're not really going to be that bothered about that as a punishment, are you?
Ms Warren, who is in charge of this, Elizabeth Warren, she's a Democrat and outspoken critic of Wall Street, she's saying, I'm not confident that the enforcement system is doing nearly enough, adding that the settlements did not appear to be translating into any deterrent for bad behaviour. That was in the FT and Bloomberg. Banks pay out $100 billion in US fines.
Well, Elizabeth Warren is positioning herself for a bid for the Democratic nomination for the presidency against probably Hillary Clinton. And she's the fundamental point here is if you fine an institution, then the individuals who've actually misbehaved are protected. And what you expect to see in these circumstances is individuals being held individually responsible for bad behaviour. And the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous US economist who's called Peter Galbraith, I believe, or James Galbraith, sorry. He is at the University of Texas, I think he is, and he's pushing very strongly that we're never going to solve this crisis unless senior people in institutions like Goldman Sachs are sent to prison. And proper prisons.
Well,
as
you
well,
mentioned
not
Goldman
just open
Sachs,
prisons.
But Goldman Sachs haven't been fined there at all. These are the major high.
Well, no, but
major high street banks.
The fact is that all of these institutions are riddled with corrupt practice.
Oh, actually, they are at the end of the list. J.P. Morgan, Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs have combined earnings of $76 billion in 2013, just sort of their collective peak in 2006. So, what this is effectively doing, this fine, is it's taking all their profits. Those combined profits of those organisations for the last year and plus a bit more. So, what they're trying to do is they're saying that you banks have got to be healthy, you've got to recapitalise, you've actually got to turn yourself back into banks that are reliable and trustworthy. But then when they make a year's profit, they're then taking that all in fines.
Yeah, but don't forget that lots of people, the shareholders have still been paid off and people have received their bonuses. So in other words, that doesn't solve the problem. And I think that in actual fact that the judicial process in dealing with this has been absolutely remiss. And of course the real problem is if you were to go properly after the bad behaviour that's taken place, and not just bad behaviour, illegal behaviour, then you would crash the system. And that's, in other words, they're able to hold everybody to ransom. And of course what happened with HSBC last year was when they were found guilty of money laundering for the drug cartels and all the rest of it, they were fined what was essentially a piddling amount of money compared to what they'd made on the transactions, and that is actually a green light to further fraud. If you know that this is the worst that's going to happen to you, then of course you know that you're absolutely in the clear to carry on doing exactly what you were doing previously. So in other words, these kind of fines are not even a deterrent, they're actually an encouragement.
Okay, back to the UK, that is this £12.4 million fine against Santander by the Financial Conduct Authority. The figures are, they say, around 300,000 customers received unsuitable advice in the time during which Santander sold nearly 350,000 products worth about $7 billion, all of which there was some flaw in. Now, I mean, you know, I'm doing my sums here. £7 billion of actual turnover generated by selling these products, but only a £12.4 million fine. I say selling, mis-selling or fraudulent selling of these products.
Well, that's right, £12.4 million sounds like a lot of money, but when you're making profits in the billions on the back of this, then it's chicken feed, and of course it's no deterrent at all. In actual fact, once you know that this is the worst that can happen to you, as I've just pointed out, it's not only not a deterrent, it's actually an encouragement. If you still don't know how much you're going to be fined, you might be sweating a bit.
So if
but
I
once
commit,
you know it's only £12.5 million, then you're fine,
fraud,
aren't you?
If I commit fraud in a bank, for example, I mean, I tell employees to say something about what they're selling which is just untrue, and then that's a fraudulent transaction. But if I'm sitting in a bank when I'm doing it, I'm okay. But if I'm outside a bank and I'm doing it from my home, I'm going to be arrested and fined.
That's right. I mean, and of course, it's only certain people who are in a position to carry out these scams. Ordinary folk are not in a position to carry out these scams. Ordinary folk cannot borrow from the Bank of England or the Federal Reserve at zero interest rates. Ordinary people have to borrow from the banks at much larger interest rates. And of course, the whole system has become essentially it's essentially a broken system, and it's on the road to disaster.
Well, she's called the enforcer, Tracy McDermott from the Financial Conduct Authority. She said that Santander had let customers down. They're also affected people who purchased premium investments as far back as 2004. I would put it to you that actually she's let customers down by imposing such a small fine. But I mean, at the end of the day, Martin, we cannot impose massive fines on these banks, can we, if it's going to crash them and if it's going to actually mean that people will lose loads of their savings. I mean, you've described to me before this situation as it's like having a suicide bomber in the room with you when you're making decisions, when government are making decisions and the Treasury are making decisions and Osborne about what they're going to do. If there's a bank in the room that says, look, if you do this, my bank's going to blow up, that is rather like having a suicide bomber in the room.
It is, but I mean, one of the other things you could do, as I suggested earlier, is go after the individuals concerned and their personal wealth, because that doesn't affect the institutional structure of the bank.
It's all very good to go for the traders. I mean, isn't this the problem here?
No, not the traders, the traders' bosses, people who cleared the traders.
Are you talking about directors or managers?
Yes. Go for individual named people. I mean, this is the whole point of having people who are company directors and all the rest of it. You are personally liable if you're engaged in fraud. Not your institution, you. And so, for example, you know, if a police officer is found to be a criminal, it's not the police that pay a fine, it's the individual police officer who is sent to prison. And that's what the same principle should be established in relation to banks. Because it's always going to be tricky if you're going to actually root out fraud, but it's going to be a lot easier if you just take down individuals and the institution, say Lloyds Bank or whatever it is protected from, because don't forget, the institution has got shareholders in it who are blameless. It's got people who hold their deposits in the bank who are blameless. Why punish them? Punish the people concerned. And that, of course, sends a very clear message. But of course, that's exactly what is not happening, because these people have enormous political and social power.
Well, it's happened in Iceland, hasn't it? I mean, this is one country, possibly also others, where bankers are being jailed for these kinds of offences, rather than we get the Financial Conduct Authority handing down a very small fine. The other thing, of course, is with Santander and these other banks, is they're still getting their massive bonuses, the people who are actually responsible for this ultimately.
Yes, so rather than paying these people bonuses, they should be in prison and their assets should be seized. That's the way to get the deficit down. Not bedroom tax, not caps on welfare. Seize the assets of the financial criminals, and we'll soon find that the books balance because they've got enough money to pay for it.
Well, this was brought up at Westminster, and that was on Wednesday this week at Prime Minister's Questions by Clive Efford at PMQs.
Clive Efford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. When bankers' salaries have gone up five times the rate of ordinary workers, and when the top 100 chief executive officers are earning 133 times the average workers employed in their companies, isn't it right that those on the highest incomes are contributing the most through tax? And with that in mind, will he then rule out any consideration of a further cut in the highest rate of tax for the richest 1%?
We said that's not our priority, but I do agree with, the Honourable Gentleman that the richest should be paying more in income tax and making a bigger contribution, and under this government that's exactly what is happening. Mr. Speaker, that is what's interesting about the Labour argument. They can't talk about jobs because there are more of them. They can't talk about inflation because it's come down. They can't talk about the deficit because we're cutting it. They've got one argument left, which is about fairness. But actually, if you look at the figures, inequality is at its lowest level since 1986. There are a million fewer people in relative poverty than when they were sitting in the cabinet. Half a million fewer children in child poverty since they were sitting in the cabinet. The facts show this is not only a government that's delivering recovery, it's a government that's delivering it in a fair way too.
Martin, is delivering a recovery. Certainly the figures are looking good, aren't they, for Cameron in the run-up to the next election. It seems to be turning the corner.
Well, don't forget, there's a long way to go between now and the spring of 2015 when the next election will be held. For example, if we had gone to war over Syria, or there is a war over Ukraine, or just a serious exchange of sanctions, the whole economy could crash. There is a housing bubble which may crash before next spring. It's definitely going to crash at some point. The question is when. And the world economy is so fragile that I'm actually of the opinion that it's most unlikely that we will reach this time next year without the economy crashing. I'll be surprised if we're still in one piece.
Hang on a minute. You've been saying that for years, Martin.
I know.
Every 5 seconds you're saying, oh, it's going to be any time now. Well, but it isn't, is it?
Well, I'll tell you what might stop it. The European Central Bank may decide to print money. And if they do, then the crash will be put off a little bit longer because there's a little bit more give in the system if they decide to go for quantitative easing as well. But if they don't, and they may not, because the Germans are still not happy about it, and there is some kind of external shock of some kind, then the whole thing will crash. And it's not just going to crash because of the British housing market's overbought, although it is. It's going to crash because the whole thing is massively overbought. Price-earnings ratios in the stock markets are completely out of line with historical realities. You can expect a mega, mega crash at some point. So all this stuff about how everything's been... this is the kind of mainstream numpty debate that goes on about Britain is turning the corner and all we've got to do is hang on in there. It's absurd. We've got quantitative easing that's been going on for 5 years, in other words, printing money, billions of pounds and dollars every month, to just to get to where we are now. And at some point, that is not sustainable. The free market economists know what I'm talking about. It's not sustainable. It's bound to crash. And when it does, all this talk of turning the corner will look like the nonsense that it actually is.
But when is that actually going to happen? Because you can't really predict it.
These banks,
all the time, that they're doing well out of all this, and they actually are acquiring a lot of assets, for example, and they're lobbying government for all sorts of changes that are positive for them. They are not going to be interested in allowing the economy to crash, are they?
No, but it may happen anyway, because ultimately you can't carry on, what's unsustainable can't be sustained. What goes up must come down. I suspect what may happen is it will happen around geopolitical problems. This is what we're dealing with now. What if China decides to seize the Senarco Islands or whatever? The Chinese economy itself is starting to turn around and go into recession. Now, all of this makes what happens in our little rowing boat on this side of the world largely irrelevant. If the Chinese economy turns round, if the US stock market collapses, if India, the Indian rupee is under attack, all of these developing market economies, Thailand, Ukraine, Argentina, Venezuela, they're all actually in crisis. Now, as they go down, they'll pull everything down with them. So discussing whether, you know, the Tory government in this country has managed by printing money to drag us out of a recession that they created, because the economy was growing when they came to power, if you remember, and all of their austerity policies killed it off. What's happened is that they've stopped the austerity policies. It's like the old joke, banging your head on a brick wall is great because it's great when you stop. And all that's happened is that Osborne, instead of having austerity, has decided to lash loads of money through Help to Buy to his own supporters. He's given people the permission to spend their pension pots and all the rest of it, and that is just basically allowing people to spend their pocket money before the crash.
You did mention this briefly last week, but can you explain what is wrong with that? I mean, surely if people have saved all their lives, put money into a pension, then they should be able to use that money.
Yes, but they've saved it with no tax paid on it, because it's actually tax-free, because it was supposedly a pension pot. But those pension pots, which have been paid for tax-free, in other words, the poor people who are paying VAT on their vegetables are subsidising those who have pensions. And they were only doing that because the understanding was it was a pension pot to be used for a pension.
VAT is not on food.
Well, all right, VAT on clothes or whatever it is you're buying. Or the point is that tax bears more heavily on the poorest, not because they pay income tax, but because indirect taxes bear much more heavily on the poorest.
A higher proportion
of your income goes on tax if you are poor than if you are rich. When you add in indirect taxes like VAT. Now, in other words,
The whole point of VAT is that it's not on basic essentials. That's the whole point of it. It's not on food. It's not on children's clothes.
All right, all right. Let me put it
if
this.
You want a takeaway, you're going to be paying VAT on it.
Yes, all right.
Or sit down in a restaurant, you're going to be paying VAT.
All economists know, and it's been known for donkey's years, there's nothing new in this, that poorer people, because of indirect taxes, are paying more as a proportion of their incomes in tax than the richest. We concentrate on income tax all the time. And, of course, we don't really have serious wealth taxes, so let's not go there. Now, the fact of the matter is that all of those people who are having their benefits cut and so on in order to pay back the deficit, those people are being robbed by the decision to allow the wealthy, because it's only the wealthy who have pensions, large numbers of people in this country, perhaps a third, a half, have no pension of any kind. Those people are subsidising that pension on the understanding that it is a pension, that it's not just money to be spent on anything. Now, in other words, by allowing people to spend that pension pot, what they're doing is allowing, say somebody goes out and buys a new car with that pension pot. A proportion of that car has actually been subsidised by the taxpayer, by the poorer taxpayer. In other words, what the government is doing is lashing support and subsidy to its own supporters. And Conservatives, it's a shame Claire isn't here to hear this. But
yeah, well, yes, just to mention, we're waiting for Claire Hiscott, who I did advise her to go round via Old Market where there wasn't too much of a traffic delay, but obviously the traffic out there is pretty awful with the delays along Eastern Way, and we're waiting for Claire Hiscott, the Conservative councillor for Horfield, to come in. Martin.
Yeah, the point I was going to make is that Conservative supporters aren't against subsidies, they're just against subsidies for poor people. Subsidies for themselves and their own supporters are fine. Look at all the farmers in this country who live on EU subsidy, which basically the British taxpayer pays into the EU budget and it comes back to keep farmers in this country.
What about the royal family, for example?
Well, indeed.
They get the civil list, which has been rename now, but they also get their farm subsidies for their land. Anyway, back to the banking stuff, and HSBC this week has been announced they're going to avoid EU bank bonus cap with their bankers' allowances, special allowance of up to £1.7 million each. Britain's biggest bank, HSBC, has revealed how its top bankers will continue to enjoy soaring pay packets despite the EU bonus cap. HSBC Chief Executive Stuart Gulliver will get £1.7 million in a fixed pay allowance on top of his £1.2 million salary in order to keep his pay high in the wake of the EU banker bonus cap. This move sees Gulliver left with £8 million total pay, up from £6.3 million the previous year. Now, this is taking the mickey, isn't it? And especially since these guys have made much of their money right now, that they've got sloshing through their coffers right now and in the high streets and the cash points that we use, those HSBC ones, from money laundering, actually from drug cartels that have been killing people, massacring them and leaving them on the edges of villages to scare everybody. And adapting their HSBC banks in Mexico to accept suitcases full of cash.
Well, indeed, and the problem is that the idea behind all of this is that these banks, which were subsidised or basically rescued by the taxpayer all over the world, we've got to get the money back that the taxpayer has spent on all of this, so the only thing they can do is go back to the casino, back to the racetrack, and try and win back, by the same mechanisms that they were using previously, the money that's been lost, so that eventually the taxpayer will be able to be bought out and we won't lose any money. Now, this is absolutely insane. What should have happened when the banks crashed in 2008 and the state steps in to bail them out is that the state then takes them over, gets rid of the existing managers completely, and many of them who behaved criminally. Look at it this way. If you're an honest businessman, it's in your interest for the criminals to be prosecuted and sent to prison and their assets to be seized. So all the money that chap's just got there, if you could prove that he was in some way responsible,
£8 million annual salary now.
Yeah, well, I mean,
from £6.3 million last year.
Yeah, well, what you do with those people is you say, right, all your assets are forfeit. That's what we do with drug dealers, isn't it? All of your assets are forfeit, and then
he will say
that we don't have to cut.
But Martin, he will say this all took place with the former chairman, Lord Green, was in charge, not me.
But the point is that Lord Green's assets. The point is about this individual. I do not know. But the point is, much of what they are doing is in fact criminal, and rather than just saying, oh, that they're earning too much for what they do. We don't even want them to do what they do, in actual fact. If we have had any sense at all, we'd stop them doing what they're doing, because what they're doing is basically engaging in criminal speculative activity, which is actually damaging to the real economy.
Well, I mean,
so rather than saying they're overpaid, we should say they're not just overpaid, they're criminals, and we should take all their assets off them and send them to prison.
I think you're quite right. There is a serious problem with whether these banks really are viable. I mean, they've sold a bit of Lloyds off again this week, only the bit which is profitable. The taxpayer is having to look after the bit that's not profitable. But ultimately, what is going to tip things so that the banking system does actually collapse? And if that ever does happen, what is the sort of thing that will tip it over the edge?
Well, it's
because we haven't seen that for 3 years of you telling us it's going to happen any time.
But don't forget, we've never had a situation where we've had quantitative easing before. The system would have collapsed a long time ago without the printing press running in the background, and therefore it's very difficult to predict at what point global investors will panic and realise that they're not going to get their money back on what.
I mean, this printing money, quantitative easing, is it as simple as this is just money going to the rich, to the stock exchange?
Yes.
Because most ordinary people aren't seeing any of it, even though billions and billions is being printed.
It's well understood that the purpose of quantitative easing is to keep asset prices up. Now, that means that those who own assets, by definition, the wealthy classes, are having their assets and or the value of their assets not just protected, but also increased through quantitative easing. Now, that's not a market solution. The von Mises Institute and other serious free market think tanks are very well aware of the reality of this. You should let the banks collapse, according to free market theory. And that means that rich people have to lose their money. And that means that they lose all of their money. And people say they don't want that. They say, well, you don't want capitalism then, because that's what capitalism means. It doesn't mean that you get your pile and then you get to keep it. In a real free market capitalist society, you can lose the lot in a crash.
Well,
and therefore, you should lose. And of course, capitalism won't work unless you do lose the lot.
And Martin, just today we've heard that Britain is charging former ICAP brokers over the rigging of LIBOR. This is just today, an hour ago, from Reuters. British fraud prosecutors began criminal proceedings against three former brokers from ICAP, the world's top interdealer broker, as a UK side of a global investigation into alleged rigging of crucial benchmark interest rates cranked up. The Serious Fraud Office said today it was charging former ICAP derivatives broker Daryl Paul Reed, his supervisor Daniel Martin Wilkinson, and Colin John Goodman, a cash broker in ICAP's London office. But again, these are people who are workers on the floor. They're not the bosses of ICAP either.
No, and as you said earlier, Tony, it's not necessarily the traders that should be. It's the traders' bosses that should bear the brunt of this.
Okay, we're joined now by Claire Hiscott. Well done
Good
for managing
evening.
To get here, Claire. You're the Conservative councillor for Horfield, I believe. Is that
I
right?
I am.
Fantastic. Well, welcome.
Good
we're
evening.
Right, you've come right into the middle of a discussion here about. I'm not sure if you're able to listen on the way in about fines for banks, and we've heard this week it's, I believe, £12 million fine for Santander. But over in the US, they've fined a selection of five different banks $100 billion. There just seems to be a bit of a soft touch over here in Britain. I mean, obviously these are for not exactly the same offences, but a twelve million pound fine for Santander is virtually nothing compared to the billions they've actually sold with the payment protection insurance.
Yes, well, it may seem a small amount, but I think we have to ask ourselves what we're then doing with that fine, because then actually what we do is we take money out of a business which is probably struggling, and then where do we put it? Just into treasury funds. I'm all for banks being brought held to account. I think the main thing is that our banks are transparent and open and working within the law, and I think that's what we need to do. And actually the main fine on a bank is when the customer says, I've had enough of you, you're not playing the game, and you move your account. That's the biggest fine.
Well,
I
back
think.
In the old days, you know, you could move your account to the People's Bank, the Co-op
you can
Bank.
Move your
for
account
example.
To anywhere
but,
now.
But the Co-op Bank is no longer the People's Bank. It's been taken over by hedge funds.
It's
So, you know, there is a limit. Slowly, the choices are being limited for us, aren't they? Anyway, look, let's just say hello to you properly, really.
I think
you've just sort of descended on us. And just tell us a little bit about you, because you getting that seat up at Horfield must have been a bit of a surprise.
I believe it was a
Lib Dem seat beforehand. How did you manage it?
How did I manage that? Somebody gave me a very good piece of advice, which said that the person that knocks on the most doors wins. And I knocked on an awful lot of doors, and that's what people want now. They want to see their politicians in the flesh and to see the whites of their eyes, and I think that's probably what swung it.
Do you think that, do you get a bad reaction too? So, oh, not a politician, go away.
Absolutely, yes. Sometimes you get that, oh, you're all the same. And actually, if you just talk to people about what really matters to them and you're honest, being honest is refreshing, I tell you. If you can get to the bottom of what people really want to know in their area, you can win everybody over if you are true and if you've got some integrity.
Well,
I don't blame you if you're fed up with politicians. Some of them are a pain.
Okay. Why the Conservative Party? Why not one of the other main parties, or the Greens even, or an independent?
Well, I always think you achieve more in a team than you do on your own, and I'm very much a team player. I would say that I was brought up in probably a Labour voting home most of the time, but was brought up to take responsibility for myself. And I think my priority has always been about responsibility than my rights. So I sort of fit with the Conservative ethos, that actually it's about helping oneself and then helping people around you who are less fortunate. And I think that's what the Conservatives have always stood for.
Well, I'm going to afraid I'm going to say
you can
to
take
you
that
now,
apart.
Well,
I'm sure you're going to.
We've had a report today from the BBC, which has been reported by many of the papers online, about the bedroom tax, and they're saying it's failed on every count. Two-thirds of the people who've been hit by the bedroom tax and now fall into arrears are disabled. Now, I mean, you're saying you've got to look after yourself, but disabled people can't.
No, I completely agree. I don't think the bedroom tax is one of my favourite policies. However, what we have had to do is look at the housing stock that we have within each local authority. And the housing stock is allocated in a bizarre fashion. If you've got a single person in a three-bedroom house in one street, and down the road you've got a single mother with four children living in a tiny flat, you know, it's obvious we need to do some swapping around. But I am very aware of some of the anomalies, and I find them very distressing. And I hope, particularly in Bristol, we are doing our best to make sure that people are supported hugely.
But it's a bit of a blunt instrument, isn't it? Just saying to people, well, we're not going to give you enough money to pay the rent, especially if they're disabled or mentally ill or something. I mean, rental arrears are up among social tenants, this report says, as a result of the bedroom tax and other benefit cuts, with 28% of them going into the red for the first time ever. So that's over a quarter of the people who are having to pay this bedroom tax or not getting enough money for their rent. It's the first time they've ever been overdrawn.
What I would say is that anybody listening who is in that situation needs to contact the council, because believe me, there is support for people within Bristol. It can appear a blunt instrument if it's not managed properly, and the main thing for anybody out there in trouble is to get on the phone to the council and talk to them. There are ways of helping everybody, and I wouldn't want to see one person suffering unnecessarily. We do have to bear in mind that this is a government that doesn't have a lot of money, and we have all got to tighten our expenditure. However, if you're in Bristol and you're in this problem, get on the phone, and believe me, there are people in the council that can help you.
And if they can't, they can always call you, Claire.
They can call me if they're in my ward. I'd love to hear from
another
them.
Aspect to all of this, and that is, of course, if people are forced to move out of council or housing association accommodation into private accommodation, you're actually paying more of their housing benefit, because it's generally quite considerably more rent.
I think what you'll find is that the whole bedroom tax was designed to bring council housing benefit in line with private benefits. So if you're in a one-bedroom flat in private ownership, that's what you get your welfare
okay,
for.
Okay, but private, if you're renting privately, you're going to be paying something like a third or maybe even
I don't think you're finding anybody being pushed out of council housing into private, certainly not in this authority.
Right.
The housing associations are behaving slightly differently, but the Bristol City Council is working incredibly hard to either move you into the right accommodation for you or to support you where you are.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, this is a pretty damning report. I mean, they're saying a tiny fraction, 6% of people affected by the bedroom tax have actually moved to a smaller home, which was the whole point of it, and only 6% have done it. The policy had two aims: to save £500 million on the housing benefits bill and to solve the problem of overcrowding by freeing up under-occupied social properties for families. There's increasing evidence the bedroom tax has failed on both counts. For a start, the projected saving has already been downgraded to £390 million, and the government on Friday suggested it may even go as low as £360 million. And there's evidence that the costs of dealing with the debt, eviction, and widespread misery caused by the bedroom tax may mean cash savings are minimal.
Well, I think it's a misconceived policy, and I think the coalition supporting councillors in Bristol are, as Claire just said, it's not your favourite policy. And I think in Bristol in particular, with the sort of coalition of all the forces that we've got George Ferguson as the mayor, we're trying to mitigate, if you like, some of the aspects of central government policy which local people are not happy with. I mean, I think the fact of the matter is it's not actually going to save much money.
They're saying actually in this report they may save no money.
Yeah, it may save no money at all, and it's going to cause a lot of misery. I think the real problem with the housing benefit bill is that we haven't got enough social housing, which means, of course, that private landlords can charge pretty much what were charging pretty much what they liked for their properties. And of course, by putting a cap on that, you've now got a situation where private landlords won't accept people on any kind of benefits. Buy-to-let landlords in Kent were saying that they wouldn't do that. So that we're building up a huge housing crisis in this country, which has been built over decades.
Okay, there's another aspect to all of this, and the last Labour
government didn't tackle this problem.
There's another aspect to all this. Poor families have been hit by welfare reforms. They are now running up £52 of debt every week. Research finds debt of low-income households as affected by benefits changes is almost £3,000, up 29% since last October. Half the participants in this survey, reported by Patrick Butler in The Guardian, said they've got no money left to live on each week once rent, food and bills are paid for. That's if they're paid for. Low-income families are running up personal debt, Claire, at the rate of £52 a week. I mean, it's like this is millions of people here actually being driven into debt. Many of, in fact, from the last story as well, people who've never been in debt before.
I agree that we do have some problems. What I would say is that when it comes to benefits, you can't expect to be on more on benefits than you would be as an average on an average salary in this country.
But I mean, surely we need to pay for these basics, that is to say, put food in people's mouths and a roof over their head. I mean, if we're not doing that,
we need to be doing that ourselves as well. So we would be helping people into work as much as we can. And I think, yes, we do have to look at the minimum wage. I know that's something that we want to be increasing to make a minimum wage a living wage, so that if you are working, you are living. And at the moment, we do have some issues where actually when you're working, you're still not paying the bills. However, if you're still it has got to be worth your while to work than it has to just stay on benefits.
But Martin, we've got over, is it 1.2 trillion national debt now, which needs servicing, and it seems that most of us are paying taxes just to service that debt. I mean, it's not surprising in Italy, which is far worse than here even. In Venice, they've just voted last week. The result came through last weekend. 90% in favour of seceding from Italy. They're paying all... because there's a lot of rich people in Venice and they're paying their taxes, but they're saying we're not seeing anything back in return in a way. I mean, we've got a similar situation. It's a similar sized city in Bristol where we're paying fantastic amounts of tax to Westminster, but they're just using it to pay the European Central Bank and to pay off a massive national debt. We don't see the results on the ground where the government is looking after the people that really need it.
Look, you cannot make the economy grow by cutting the incomes of the poorest people. A, because in actual fact, it doesn't. You're not going to improve their circumstances, and it's unfair. But B, because in actual fact, that doesn't work. The austerity agenda is fundamentally flawed. What's actually happened is that we've stopped the austerity agenda. Things like Help to Buy, for example, are subsidising those already on the property ladder to buy better properties for themselves. That is a subsidy. That's as much as a subsidy as paying somebody to have an extra room, or supposedly an extra room in social housing. And what we're doing, what people are beginning to perceive, and quite rightly, is the unfair distribution of sacrifices. And in any case, sacrifice is not the way forward. Ultimately, you can't grow the economy by cutting people's wages and benefits. It doesn't work.
And it doesn't really. I mean, we were talking before you arrived, Claire, about Stuart Gulliver, the chief executive of HSBC. He's just managed to get around all these pay caps by the EU. Well, the city doesn't seem to be very interested in those, but the EU do. And he's now on £8 million a year total pay, up from £6.3 million. I mean, it's just like another world.
It is another world. I don't think anybody's worth £8 million a year, but probably equally neither is a footballer worth that sort of money. So I think we need to look at wages across the board. I think if you can't just single out the bankers.
I mean, it's almost like feudalism. I mean, I can imagine he has this, with his £8 million, he's paying all these little servants.
He may well be just the same as a high wage footballer can be doing exactly the same thing. And I think we need to look across the board at how we're valuing people and how we're paying them. I am all for fair wages for what people contribute to a business, and I certainly wouldn't question looking at an £8 million salary.
Now, neither would I. There is one person that's really stirring the pot, though, particularly this week, and that's Nigel Farage in the UK Independence Party.
He likes stirring pots.
We've had a quite unique thing this week, which is this debate with Nick Clegg and Nigel Farage. Mm-hmm. So let's have a listen to some of the closing comments towards the end of the debate there. And I think it's Nigel Farage that speaks first, and there's a little bit of an exchange. This is a couple of minutes, but it'll give you a flavour of how that went. We can discuss it afterwards.
The British government has actually G'd up the European Union to pursue, effectively, an imperialist, expansionist, and even Mr Barroso, the Commission President, once himself said, you know, that we are building an empire. We've given a false series of hopes to a group of people in the Western Ukraine. So G'd up were they, that they actually toppled their own elected leader. That provoked Mr Putin, and I think the European Union, frankly, does have blood on its hands in the Ukraine, and I don't want a European army, navy, air force, or a European foreign policy. It has not been a thing for good in the Ukraine.
We come to our closing statements. Again, it falls to Nick Clegg to go first. It has to be a tight minute, Deputy Prime Minister. Please start.
You know what's at stake here? British jobs, safety, our economic recovery, our place in the world. So don't be fooled, because quitting Europe would put all of that at risk. All of it. And it would also turn us into a country that we don't want to be, closed and narrow, isolated. I want us to be Great Britain, not Little England. And if you feel the same, then now is the time to make your voice heard, because Labour and the Conservatives are going to do nothing, nothing to stop us heading towards the exit. So if you believe, as I do, even if you haven't voted for the Liberal Democrats before, but if you believe that we're better off in, then at least on this occasion, on May the 22nd, in the European elections, I hope you will give us your support.
Thank you. Mr. Clegg, thank you. A minute for you. Thank you. Nigel Farage.
Nick Clegg did not answer the question that I repeatedly asked him tonight, namely, is it true that we have a total open door to 485 million people from Europe, many of them from poor countries? He wouldn't answer that. The answer is yes, we have a total open door, and that is the issue, I think, that has woken people up, that by being a member of the European Union, we've lost the ability to govern our country and to control our borders. Now, you know, Nick represents a tired status quo, defending a model that maybe 40 years ago looked like a good idea, but leaves us totally unfit to compete in a 21st century global economy. Trade with Europe, cooperation with Europe, friendship with Europe, but I'm British. I believe the best people to govern Britain are the British people themselves, and I believe that by divorcing ourselves from this failed project, not only will we free Britain, we'll provide a good example for much of the rest of Europe too. I think the majority of people are now on our side. They believe we must get our country back. We're going to fight damned hard in the next few weeks and put that choice on the ballot paper for you on May the 22nd.
Nigel Farage, thank you for that.
That was recorded earlier this week. That was the debate organised, I think it was by LBC, London radio station, and Sky together. Now, Claire, this has always been a bit of a running sore for the Conservatives, but what are your thoughts on UKIP? And this, because you can't have it both ways. You can't be in Europe and out, can you?
I think you can be in a Europe that's working for Britain. I think Nigel Farage has given up on Europe and just wants out without any talking. And I think Nick Clegg, unfortunately, is just quite happy to carry on with the status quo. I think what we've been offering you, the country as Conservatives, is a dialogue, a debate, a renegotiation of some of the powers that we've unwisely given over to Europe. And I think actually what people do want is time to look at Europe, renegotiate some of those powers back to Britain. And I don't agree with Nick Clegg or Nigel Farage. I think there's a middle way, and I think that's why the Conservatives are offering you a renegotiation and then a referendum.
Yeah, but that's
the only way forward, really.
But is there really going to be any real renegotiation? Because that would have to bring all the other European countries on board to do that. It seems to me that's a pie in the sky idea.
No, I think there's a lot of countries who want to renegotiate. I think the Germans are realising that the European project's not necessarily working for them. I think lots of countries are seeing that the way that everybody's economy works differently means that one size does not fit all. And it was, you know, it was a pie-in-the-sky idea, this, oh, we'll all be the United States of Europe. I think there's many countries in the European Union who want to look again at the way the whole thing's constructed.
Martin, this debate, what are your thoughts? I mean, one of the big things that came up there, I'll ask Claire about in a minute, is immigration, because Nigel Farage is saying this is the issue which has actually put this on the agenda. Otherwise, most of the main political parties would rather just forget about the fact that Britain is now really, in many ways, ruled from Brussels.
Yes, well, I mean, I don't think Britain is ruled from Brussels. I think that's an exaggeration. I think the free movement of labour within the EU clearly is causing problems, especially in a time of recession and cutbacks and so on.
Now, I don't want to intervene too much, Martin.
That is clearly going to create great social tension.
In the Telegraph this week, the House of Commons Library saying that up to half of British laws come from Europe. So, I mean, it's both, isn't it? We're all from Westminster and from Brussels.
Yeah, well, if you're going to be part of a club, you've got to abide by the rules of the club or get out. I mean, that's the way it works. I mean, Norway, for example, has always refused to join the EU, largely because, unlike Britain, in Norway, they saw the EU as a capitalist project and they wanted to have a more socialist policy. They had higher minimum wages than were allowed in Europe and so on. But they also, they have to pay in to the EU budget in order to get their exports accepted inside the EU, including in Britain, without a tariff on them. Now, in other words, even if Britain left the EU, we would either have a tariff wall against our exports, or we would have to pay into the EU budget, but without having any say over how that budget is spent. So in the real world, the choices are not nearly as straightforward as people think. And I think what will happen, I tend to agree with you, Tony, I don't think there is much renegotiation to be done, because you've got to get all of these people able to agree to it, and they're not going to. What will probably happen, I think, is that Euroland, although the countries that are using the euro, will decide to go for a much closer union between those countries. But Britain outside the euro, Norway outside the EU, we won't be able to influence those discussions.
Claire, well, what about the issue of immigration, hundreds of thousands of people that can come to Britain at any time? I mean, is that something you're happy with?
I think immigration has been a very hot topic, and I think it's probably something we should have looked at years and years ago before we entered into the EU agreement. I think one thing that upsets me so much about our open borders policy is that we have poorer countries now having a brain drain, and they're losing some really good people. And the whole idea of the EU was to raise the poorer nations. And actually, with our open borders policy now, it's so easy to leave a country rather than help it recover. Immigration is a problem purely because we just don't have enough houses. It's not that we aren't going to have enough jobs. I mean, I think we're back on the road to recovery in our economy. But it's a very complex topic, one that you can't just talk about in a minute on the radio. I think we do need to be careful that we don't overreact. I think some people have got on an emotional bandwagon of slight racist tendencies of, oh, they're not quite like us, so we don't want them. It's absolutely ludicrous. Immigrants have historically brought so much into Britain, and we are richer for it. But what we don't want is to find that we really cannot cope. And I think the main thing that upsets me is that there are poorer countries who are losing some fantastic talent because we're not helping them.
Okay, so if you had to vote for one or the other, Farage or Clegg?
Oh dear, I think that might be the first time I've ever not voted.
Really?
And I'm a great Pankhurst fan that you should always vote. No, I'm not even going to be drawn. I think I'd have to say I would abstain.
Okay. Now, you were talking about house building, and there's concerns in the impact of homes. This is a Bristol story in the Post today. A number of concerns were raised at a Bristol inquiry into the number of new neighbour and impact of a new neighbourhood north of the city. The Cribbs Patchway development, South Gloucestershire.
Yes, impacting my ward.
We'll see 5,700 new homes built, 50 hectares of employment land, plus supporting facilities and infrastructure. This includes land at the former Filton Airfield. Outline planning permission is granted on Thursday for the first of three major housing developments which will make up that neighbourhood. A scheme by Persimmon Homes and Ashfield Land will see the construction of up to 1,100 homes on the 133-acre site at Fishpool Hill near Cribbs Causeway. Now, just as an anecdote, I was chatting to somebody the other day who's involved in volume house building. They said that the building that's already going on up at Filton is some of the worst he's seen anywhere in the country. The houses are sort of small, rooms are small in them, and also the way they're laid out is as if there hasn't been very much care and attention paid to it. The way the roads look are not very appealing, and this is not a very good thing to be happening right near you, is it?
Okay. I mean, I would be disappointed if South Gloucestershire Council haven't looked at the plans and produced, in essence, a new village, which is actually going to be a pleasant place to live. I would hope that would be something that in Bristol we wouldn't do. I mean, I haven't looked at the houses. I think the main thing for Bristol is, and people in North Bristol, is that what we're really worried about is the transport infrastructure. And if you can't get around, there's no point in building lots of new houses if we're all stuck in one big car park. And I was at a meeting last night with the council and looking at some of these issues. We all know that homes need to be built, but you know, we want to build homes, not houses, I think George Ferguson was saying today. And I'm hoping that with some good negotiations and some constructive common sense talking, we could see that this being quite a success, as long as we get that transport infrastructure right. I would say I have no idea on the design of the homes. That's down to South Gloucestershire.
It just looks horrid, apparently. Anyway, I mean, I've driven past it. It's not the sort of place that I would choose. I mean, if you've got no choice, maybe. Also, I must say that the development will also include a new local centre, primary school, leisure and community facilities, and transport infrastructure.
Yes, it's not very clear about the transport infrastructure. We're really pushing for
maybe
them to
open. Maybe that's a bike lane or something.
Well, we're pushing for them to fund the reopening of some of the stations. We must look at non-road transport. And let's be real, not everybody can cycle everywhere. So I think there's a lot of work to be done with those planners.
I mean, the thing is, I mean, I worked up in Filton for, well, a year or so, and the traffic was absolutely terrible, really awful, every morning, every evening. You're just sitting in the car for half an hour, hardly going anywhere. Now, this is just going to make things doubly, quadruply worse.
Well, if we open some of the existing railways, I think we've got lots of commuter traffic.
Well, you'll get a few.
Well, no, I think if you look at
because
some...
Because trains don't go necessarily where you want to go, do
no,
they?
No, but if you look at some of the other cities in this country, look at Newcastle and Sunderland, fantastic metro system, rail system, even joined up with the ferries, you can go where you want to go in Newcastle and Sunderland, and it could be easily done here.
I mean, they've been talking about this for decades.
I know, they need to stop talking and start doing.
I think the best way to do it is to make sure everyone's sitting in their car for at least an hour without going anywhere.
Just like
I have to use the train.
Just getting here.
Well, they have to use the train then, and they'll be forced. Anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts about this this new development up at Filton? Because it's obviously, you know, there's a lot of people worried that there just isn't the infrastructure to cope with all these new homes.
Well, let's reel back a stage before that. What Filton Airfield perhaps should not have been given over to this purpose at all. You should have been thinking if there was any real plan.
But
the airfield was actually part of the production infrastructure of Bristol.
But it was BAE Systems land. They can sell it to who they want to sell it to.
When BAE Systems was owned by the taxpayer, as it used to be, they wouldn't have been allowed to do that. And in actual fact, in Germany and Japan, they certainly would not have allowed a facility like that to be sold off for quick profit, as has happened in this case. Then, of course, we've not been able to stop the selling of the airfield. The airfield's been sold, and now we're dealing with the follow-on impact of creating a new village, as it were. In other parts of Europe, you don't get volume house building like we do in Britain. It's a cultural thing. People actually customise their own houses. They buy their own, they buy an individual house which has been individually designed for them. Only in Britain do we have this huge, development of massive estates that all look the same.
Okay. An exclusive in the Independent this week, a secret second Metropolitan Police corruption probe is revealed. This is Tom Harper, one of my favourite journalists. I must say, he produces some fascinating stuff. He's got some excellent contacts in the police. Metropolitan Police corruption scandal has deepened after the Independent uncovered the existence of a previously secret investigation into criminal officers that went much further than the files destroyed by Scotland Yard. Operation Zloty, a wide-ranging inquiry spanning 9 years, found dozens of rogue detectives in the employ of organised crime and operating with virtual immunity. Long-term intelligence developments operation include information on police corruption originally gathered by 17 other investigations, Operation Othona, the contents of which were inexplicably shredded sometime around 2003. Mark Martin, this is pretty serious stuff, isn't it? Dozens of rogue detectives in the employ of organised crime running around in Scotland Yard.
Well, it reminds me of when I think it was Paul Condon took over as Metropolitan Police Commissioner in the 1980s, and he gave a press conference as he'd taken over. He said, "Do you want the bad news or the good news? I'll start with the bad news." He said, "The bad news is 200 and some odd of my officers are corrupt. The good news is we're keeping an eye on them." And you might think that sounds awful, but in reality, in the real world, that's my uncle used to be in the Birmingham Police for 25 years. The reality is that organised crime infiltrates the police force. It always has. It always will.
Okay, Claire.
Another police
Claire, just,
have to
I'm afraid
with.
We haven't got a lot of time. Just
no,
in a quick
fine.
Sentence, this. What's your reaction to this? Because we can't have organised crime running around in the corridors
no,
of Scotland Yard.
No, we can't. And the more that we uncover, the better. You know, if we can uncover corruption now, then we're moving on
okay.
to police.
Thank you to this
trust.
Week's guest. That was Conservative Councillor for Hawfield,
Good
Claire
evening.
Hiscott. We're back after the news.
BCFM on 93.2 online. And on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, prosecutors have announced veteran DJ Dave Lee Travis will be charged with a new count of indecent assault. He'll also face a retrial over two charges a jury who recently cleared him of 12 similar counts couldn't reach verdicts on. The radio presenter has given this statement outside Southwark Crown Court.
I said the last two times I've spoken to you guys that it's been a bit of a nightmare. And the only thing I want to say on this is the nightmare is continuing.
Five planes involved in the hunt for the missing Malaysian Airlines flights have all spotted several objects in the Indian Ocean. The search has shifted further north after new data suggested the passenger jet came down sooner than previously thought. Police have confirmed a body found on a nature reserve in Newport is a missing local teenager. 19-year-old Nida Nazir vanished in December. Detectives say post-mortem tests could take weeks to complete. They're formally treating her death as